This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
It's crypto summer, which means it's festival season. At Real Vision, we're getting ready for the next Festival of Learning in partnership with Kraken. It's taking place April 18 and 19, and the theme is Don't F Up Alts, Memes, and NFTs. Yep, there's a big world of digital assets beyond Bitcoin and ETH with lots of opportunity and lots of risk. We'll be bringing a ton of timely and actionable knowledge from speakers including Raul Powell, Sergio Silva, Kevin Kelly, OSF, and more. It's completely free to attend. Just go to realvision.com/festivalofLearning to get the details and save your seat. We'll see you there. Is the Fed's inflation target dead? Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. With me today is Vincent Dilawar, Director of Global Macro Strategy at StoneX. Hi, Vincent. Welcome back.
Hi, Maggie. Very happy to be here.
Yeah, great day. There's a lot going on. Well, it's not a great day, but it's a great time to have someone on to sort of shed some light on it, or at least give us your view, because it's really been all about inflation, right? This whole week, really for the last couple of weeks. And we've seen, you know, shifting thoughts. You have long been on the record as an inflationista. You've been arguing that we're in a period of higher prices, higher rates. This week, the market certainly sat up and paid attention. The inflation numbers were hotter for the most part. Stocks and bonds came under pressure. But for some, as we've been having conversations, this seems like it's an issue of timing rather than a broad or a new regime that we're in. At least that seems like that's where the debate is. Let's have a listen to some of the highlights of our conversations, then we'll talk on the other side.
We think that the economy, just like flipping a switch, goes from an expansionary period to a recessionary period. When in these types of situations, really all business cycles, there is a usually drawn out process to move from one to the other. And this cycle has been elongated in every fashion and every facet, far more than maybe any other in economic history, for a variety of reasons. Everything that I look at still tells me that we're in the downswing of the cycle, and that hasn't actually changed.
The 10-year got to some really critical levels today, like 455. We're at this upper channel. I mean, it should start consolidating here, because if it doesn't, there is that risk towards a gap towards like 475. And that's not something to kind of scoff at, because if you remember from November 1st until now, and the really big first start of the rally in both credit and then which helped out equities and everything else, was tens went from 5 to 3.75. Then it stabilized somewhere around 4, 4.25. Nobody really paid attention. Like, all right, as long as tens are in the fours, low fours, and we'll keep buying stocks and equity and credit, right? But if it starts to go back up again and it doesn't feel like it's going to stop, this is where the trio of the three macro, which is the 10-year rate, the dollar, and oil, those three things can fast track a pretty big risk reduction in the market.
Yeah, I'm not too worried about default. So we're seeing that demand every time spreads start to widen, that demand really comes in. We also had a lot of participation in the market on the private credit side. So it's taken some of the supply away. That normally would probably have ended up in the high yield market. So I think that that's been a component as well. But it has held in, but still a little bit cautious because, you know, when the spread moves, it spikes.
And that's really just the tip of the iceberg of the conversations that we're having across the Real Vision platform, both macro, crypto, trying to figure out, you know, what's different, what's changed, what's the same. And we have such a diverse range of opinions. So as usual, you can get access to it all. To join and find the right level for you, just hit the link in the chat. So Vincent, what is your sense? Is this just a matter of pushing back the timing of potential easing, or is there a different dynamic going on?
Sure, it's going to be different this time, you know, like the other 12 months that it was supposed to be different. I mean, I don't know. How long is long enough? The last sub 2% inflation print was February of 2021. So more than 3 years now. How long is transitory? I mean, how long before, you know, you call, start calling a spade and accept that we've moved into a world of structurally higher deficits, structurally higher inflation and structurally higher rates. I mean, the bond market has been fighting this reality tooth and nail. We are in a rare moment of clarity. Now, if you look at the futures implied probabilities, we're looking at, you know, between 2 and 3 cuts by the end of the year, which is more or less what the Fed has guided. You know, just 2 months ago, you know, we were pricing 7 cuts. I mean, that tells you how much delusion there is amongst the supposedly smart fixed income market. So to me, no, it's not a question of timing. Of course, there will be ebbs and flows. Who knows? Maybe this whole geopolitical drama clears up. I certainly hope it does. We could see some, you know, some relief at this point. It looks like oil really is the dark night that, you know, drives the three apocalypse horsemen of higher rates, higher dollar and higher oil prices. So maybe that goes down. Yeah, we could get some relief again. It's not my expectation, but my forecast is that whatever relief we get is going to be temporary, and that eventually we'll go back to where we are. We'll go back to seeing 5% 10-year yield. We'll go back to talk about rate hikes, not cuts. And eventually we'll start considering, which I think should be what should be obvious to everyone, which is we no longer live in a 2% inflation world, and that we need to acknowledge that. And I think once the sooner we do that, the better it will be for everyone involved.
It's interesting you say that the bond market's been fighting it tooth and nail, because you're right. You know, we've seen the yields pop up and then they go back down, and everyone thinks that's the turn that they've been waiting for. And it's been, in a way, that bonds usually aren't so volatile. In fact, Marty F. saying, hey, all, stop the pain. And I think everyone felt that, right? We see bond yields back really kind of pinned toward that 4.5, big question mark, where they go from there. And stocks, stock route today, S&P worst day since January. But we see, you know, losses of 1% across the board, 2% for the Russell, the VIX up 16%. So there is a lot of hand-wringing and angst contributing to that mood. By the way, JP Morgan CEO, bank earnings are coming out, Jamie Dimon saying that even though some of the economic indicators are good, that they are very alert to these risks really out there, including what you mentioned, overseas conflict, but also those inflationary pressures. You can understand why people are confused though, because you also have Larry Fink from BlackRock coming out and saying, yeah, I think there'll be Fed rate cuts. So it's, you know, this is what's, I think, you know, really been perplexing for people. So we took the question right from your research note: is the inflation target dead? You think so, right? And you think 2%?
It was not a question in my research.
Yeah, no, ours was. We start with a question. There is no question. You think it's dead?
Yeah, that's a quick answer. And it's funny you should mention Larry Fink. It was just today he came up with basically. I mean, he's a smart guy. I mean, he's known that for a long time, but you know, finally, he came out public by saying, hey, if we get down to 2.93%, that's a win for everybody. And when you see someone like Larry Fink, you know, world largest asset manager, start, you know, agreeing with crazy lunatics like me, that tells you that, you know, the pendulum is swinging. I mean, I love that quote about, I think it might be Gandhi or Schopenhauer or Elizabeth Holmes, one of the three. Possibly all three about truth. You know, I'm going to go Schopenhauer because it sounds smarter. You know, the truth is first, you know, completely ignored. Then it's violently fought against. And then eventually it's accepted by anyone, everyone as evidence. And I've certainly seen that when it comes to the inflation target. And I think we're getting to stage three here, where you see very kind of mainstream consensual voices like Mohammed Airline, Alarian, like Larry Fink, telling you what was obvious, you know, 2 years ago, is that we cannot have a 2% inflation target if we have structural deficit of 7% of GDP. I mean, any central banker in emerging market can tell you that. Anyone who's studied basic math can tell you that. And we know the deficit is not going down. And it will be a lot easier to raise the target. And now it's really the matter of just kind of acknowledging it and doing it in a way that doesn't, you know, rattle markets too much. And lets the U.S. government finance itself at rates we can afford.
Hey, everyone. We're going to take a quick break right now to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing. In an era where AI, robotics, biotech, and digital assets are reshaping our reality, staying ahead is not just an option, it's a necessity for investors and entrepreneurs. Investors who embrace the technological revolution will benefit from the evolving investment landscape. Understanding these shifts is crucial for reaping future rewards. Today, we're giving you access to a free Real Vision membership and access to one of our most popular videos with Real Vision co-founder and CEO Raul Pal and David Matten, founder of New World Same Humans. This thrilling conversation between two experts is a deep dive into the profound technological shift that's begun and how it's transforming not just financial markets, but our entire way of life. Head to realvision.com/exponential age. That's realvision.com/exponential age to get free access today.
You've heard the headlines. Inflation is unchecked. The dollar is collapsing. The government is printing too much money. The fear is real, but there is a solution: gold. The government can't print more gold. Gold isn't collapsing, and gold's value increases during inflationary times. Noble Gold Investments is here to help you protect your wealth. Noble Gold Investments is the gold IRA company that Americans trust. The founders of Noble Gold have more than 20 years of combined experience in buying gold and silver. They have secured more than $1 billion in precious metals for their clients. Whether you're a seasoned investor or new to the game, Noble Gold Investments simplifies and secures your gold investment journey. Choose between a tax-advantaged gold IRA or have physical gold delivered to your door. Noble Gold Investments ensures a seamless and easy transaction. Invest in something you can hold. Go to noblegoldinvestments.com/vision to get started. That's noblegoldinvestments.com/vision.
There's so many questions that come up with that, but I want to ask one from Sebastian right now, because I want to sort of stay, before we talk about sort of policy and the implications of that, I want to stay with the inflation issue. And Sebastian said, hey, everyone, I'm quite confused about inflation. CPI 10-year rates say higher for longer, but trueflation is way below 2%. Right. Where does this strong discrepancy come from? Great question, Sebastian.
Yeah, I'm not especially for the on the trueflation number. I think a lot of that comes from prices that are scraped off the web. So there may be a bias towards the kind of core goods category that, you know, really went up like crazy in 2021, 2022, and now come down on the back of, you know, retailers liquidating excess inventories, supply chains getting better. There may be less of a weight. To me, the real driver of inflation are, you know, shelter, healthcare and wages. These are the three big ones. And shelter is not coming down the way people expected it would. If anything, my impression is that we still need to catch up. I mean, if you look at a chart of the case shelter versus the owner's equivalent rent or the rent in the CPI versus zero observed rent index, I mean, we're still 20 percentage points below. So that catch-up process is not done. Healthcare is a complete disaster. The way it's computing the CPI, it's called a retained earnings method for health insurers that messes everything up. The weight is off. I mean, I could go on forever on healthcare, but just, you know, reality is healthcare costs are increasing by 7, 8, 9% a year.
And I think that everyone feels that.
Right. And it's amazing. Everyone except the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So.
That's right.
but you know, there's a, I love this, I don't know if you remember the original Jurassic Park movie. It's the beginning and they're doing the tour of the park. Jeff Goldblum, the mathematician, you know, they're presenting him, oh, the dinosaurs cannot have babies because they're all female and blah, blah, blah. And then life finds a way. Yeah. I love that quote. Life finds a way. And I think that applies to the CPI, right? I mean, you have basically your economists that work really hard with hedonic adjustment and messed up shelter and understating healthcare CPI, but life finds a way. Someone is paying this insurance premium. And my impression is that it's going into wages, which is why we cannot seem to get under control these kind of core services like shelter, that part of the CPI, which really should bother people. If you look on a 6-month annualized, you're probably only at 6-7%. That's basically all wages, right? This is your waiters, your hairdresser, your plumbers, your car repair, your attorneys. And that part, I mean, not huge, but that's really the part that should give the Fed nightmare. And, you know, in the metaphor, that's the T-Rex, right? Life finds a way. The high, because you need to pay people higher because, real estate prices have rebounded and they're extraordinarily affordable, especially with the way mortgage rates are. And the health insurance costs are much, much, much higher than what the BLS tells you. So if you try to hide it from one part of the CPI, it pops up in another part.
That's right. That's absolutely right. I love that. great question from Serge as well. Could the fiscal policy be giving too much liquidity to a strong economy, working counter-purposes to the Fed? I think we absolutely know that's the case. And it was sort of not well appreciated. Although I will say that you, Vincent, have, to be fair, been talking about this forever with us. And we're really in a contrary camp, bringing up populism, bringing all of that up really, really early on. So you should get credit for that. But I think the interesting thing you raise and why we started the show with your statement, we made it a question. We know the fiscal is working counter to the Fed. You're kind of saying the Fed's rolling over and not going to try to fight it anymore or fight it to the extent that it would need to bring inflation back under control. That is very important.
And to be honest, I mean, I always thought that would be the end game. I just didn't think it would come as early as March. Because I got fooled by Powell. I mean, Powell is a pretty smart guy, and I thought he talked a good game in 2022. You know, Jackson Hole, there will be pain. And then
he inflicted some with
QT and all that. Like he talked a good game. And then we had, perfect alignment of the macro stars, second half 2023, base effect was working for you. China supply chains were clearing up. China was reopening, but reopening on the supply side, not so much, boosting demand the way everybody thought. Mm-hmm. So we had this kind of golden moment, right? And we said, oh my God, like they nailed it. They got the soft landing. We can have our cake and eat it. And then I think that kind of translate, I think I always thought it was kind of an illusion, honestly. I thought a lot of that was, truly transitory, not like the 2021 transitory. It was about, supply chain. It was about destock, whatever. But for a few glorious months, it seemed like everything was under control. And then what started to take over because of that kind of fairy tale scenario playing out was asset prices started rallying like crazy.
Right, because rates dropped.
Correct. Oh, we've got this down. We've got high growth forever. Rates are going to drop. We see this monster rally build across pretty much every asset. And to me, this was the moment when history books will be written, the moment when the Fed abandoned the 2% target, I will tell you, was that March press conference when maybe second or third question, a journalist asked Powell about financial conditions. Now, Powell is a smart man. He knows what financial condition means. Financial condition basically means stock price.
We can all see it with our eyes.
And bond spread, right?
Right.
That's what it means.
And then he completely
dodges and gives this crazy answer on the Taylor rule. We think that model policy is still restrictive, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. He gave the all clear signal to the market. Okay, go buy trade monkey JPEG and go buy some gold, which of course everyone did. It's shocking because if it had been Lagarde, like Lagarde's a little slower on the head, I would maybe have been okay, like, she just, she's a lawyer. She doesn't know what financial conditions are. But Jay Powell, he did it knowingly. And he knew that by saying that, he would trigger this kind of epic buy everything rally. And that's when you saw, if you get break evens, been straight up since then.
So it's so interesting you say that, because I think that the market was bracing for him to slap it down. Do you remember we went into that? There was a lot of concern.
So,
that he would
so was I. I went on Twitter putting a long thread on like why Jay Powell's going to smack the market.
And because he'd done it before and he talked about Volcker and, you know, like that was so with that sort of genie coming back out, everybody, and you're right, it was very, very notable. Something really jumped out at me in your note. You said they are deliberately relaxing their inflation focus in order to prioritize their employment and asset price mandate. They don't have an asset price mandate, but you're saying you're just calling
not in the book. No, they don't.
Yeah, not in the book. They're just, you know, as we know, technically their mandate, dual mandate is full employment and price stability. It is not.
At this point, you may throw a fourth mandate that has to
do. Yeah, exactly. Like, you're just calling it, right. But I thought it was interesting because you are just addressing the elephant in the room.
But the funny thing about, you know, jokes aside about the Fed being political and all that, which, you know, I don't know how I stand on that, but the asset price mandate was more or less theorized by Bernanke in a 2010 speech, I think, about the wealth effect. You know, basically, I mean, it should have been rejected because it was bogus economics, but is the basically trickle down applied to monetary policy. By inflating the value of the S&P 500, I'm making people feel richer and then they will spend. And as a result, that gets me at the time, you know, we had too low inflation, too low growth. That was a problem. So boosting asset prices basically was seen as a legitimate tool of Fed policy. And he theorized that. I think, you know, that was wrong, but whatever. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and I'm not, this is not an economic comment at all, like, because I totally understand what you're saying, but we all remember what was happening at that time and the wheels were coming off the global financial system. So he was perhaps suggesting that's an economic theory. I would say that, like, in the kind of old fashioned way where sentiment and symbols matter, that if that was the goal,
it was kind of putting a floor
like it may be really bad economic policy, but in terms of sort of, you know, I don't know the exact right word to say, but the sentiment that, you know, and think back to like shovel and pick and, you know, what Roosevelt did, I think it was on that. But that brings up a point that some people talk about, the financialization of the economy.
We're going to take another quick break to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you been using Mint to manage your finances? Good news and bad news. First, the bad news. Mint is shutting down. The good news, there's a better alternative. Many Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it. Monarch is a top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, cash flow, net worth, and more. Plus, create custom budgets, track progress towards financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now, listeners for this show will get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/vision. Monarch also has built-in features to collaborate with your partner, family, or financial advisor. Invite them to your account at no extra cost, and they'll get their own login info and a joint view of all your finances. After reading reviews, you can understand why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, listeners of this show will get a 30-day extended free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/vision. That's monarchmoney.com/vision for your extended 30-day free trial. Go to monarchmoney.com/vision.
Right. One last thing I want to mention, that the reason I brought that 2010 speech is because back then inflation was not high enough. So the justification was, oh, we need high asset pricing in order to feed inflation. Mm. And my point is that it's not symmetrical. Today we have the exact opposite problem. Inflation is way too hot and it's kind of stabilizing as I was expecting at a plateau of like 3.54%. But if it truly this were, you know, a legitimate economic argument, which we both know it was not, then you would say, well, that must be because asset prices are too high. I'm going to lower asset prices in order to bring inflation down. But you see, it's kind of asymmetry in the reaction, right? When inflation is too low, yes, you boost asset prices. When inflation is too high, well, you also boost asset prices. And I really think it's the crux of the problem right now is asset prices. Because we've seen interest rates hike don't really work. Like we have this extremely liquid economy where, you know, people have refinanced at very low rates. So what higher rates mean for me? I mean, I locked in my mortgage at 2%. So I get basically an annuity from the Fed on my cash. You know,
there's no way to rein in inflation without destroying generational wealth and assets.
I would believe that interest rates don't work.
that's terrible.
Liquidity,
that's a terrible scenario.
You can't do it with liquidity because we had the Silicon Valley Bank crisis. We see what happens if you tighten too much. You already see the Fed actually, you know, kind of tapering quantitative tightening. So rates don't work. It doesn't work. Then you have Yellen, you know, spending like a drunk salesman. Deficits of 7% of GDP.
Oh, yeah, technically so Congress. Congress spends the money, not Treasury. Just small.
Yes.
Because they all pretend they didn't when they try to not raise the debt ceiling. They all pretend they didn't. They didn't do that vote.
Let's just say there's a bipartisan consensus on
spending like a drunken sailor. Absolutely, okay.
Yellen is the one.
Everyone agrees.
Executing, signing the checks. Okay. So you have this massive. The other question I was alluding to was the fiscal impact that's running against you. Rates are not working. You cannot do liquidity. What do you have left as a central banker? The only thing you have left, if you're serious about bringing down inflation, is asset prices. You need to hammer it down. Like basically,
which is why they're not going to do it.
Yes.
That's exactly. Because they can't.
Yes.
They can't. I mean, the fallout would be, and it's real. It's not just the popularity, credibility. To destroy assets for people who need them to retire, because remember, Americans are most of retirements tied to the asset market. It's not pension based anymore. Create that's a whole, you know, which seemed like a great idea to privatize that, but this is the other unintended consequence of that you have financialized the economy or tied assets to people's well-being in a way that they never were a generation ago when you got a pension.
Which is why I think, you know, there's a part of me that still hates boomers that kind of wants this to happen, like this kind of great reset, and boomers to, sell their overpriced homes and take some pain and some share in this readjustment. But I agree with you. It's not going to happen. So
it's generational, right? Because the people suffering now are the younger people.
Yeah.
In order to protect the retirement of boomers.
My view is always, okay, somehow we need to default on the boomers. And it's probably better to do it in real term than in nominal terms. Mm-hmm. Instead of, you know, lowering the value of every asset, I think you just basically increase inflation and you reach the same outcome.
So here's a really interesting question. What boomers are the biggest voting bloc. We know we have an age situation where those are the voters that matter. What if young people start turning out in droves? They outnumber. They just don't vote, but they outnumber. A couple elections ago, somebody had a great statistic about as all of these, you know, millennials and everybody come to age voting. They way outnumber boomers. They just don't vote, so they don't exercise their political power. What if they start doing that? Do they start voting for different? Anyway, listen, I want to ask about, so first of all, you also think recessions are dead. I'm just throwing that headline out there, but I want to ask about, because we have such limited time, a couple of questions come up, and this is really important, war. Questions about war, the geopolitical risks that are out there, and what it means for oil, because this is, as you hinted at, this is a really important part of the equation when everyone's getting really concerned about inflation. These inflation readings are going to roil the market now as they come in. So, Ralph saying, what is your view on crude oil? There's an elevated call buying on Brent. We've had attacks on Russian oil infrastructure and a purported imminent attack on Israel by Iran or its proxies. What do you see happening with oil?
I mean, I'm really not the right guy to answer that question, but I'm going to do it anyway. So you can.
Well, let me give you a different one that maybe you're thinking.
But I'm going
for it.
Let's go. Let's be stupid. Okay. So I think that the latest lag, I mean, you have many issues on oil. You have OPEC maintaining the cuts. You have U.S. output not raising enough. You have the economy picking up. You have not from this recession. Europe getting a little bit better. So you have this, I would say, somewhat bullish fundamental background. It's not purely geopolitical. But if you look at that last, like, you know, parabolic leg up, that's really, you know, is Iran going to nuke Israel on Monday? And I'm going to go on the record and say that Iran is not going to nuke Israel on Monday. Because if they do anyway, we'll have other things to worry about than, you know, my forecast. Yeah. Short term, I think you have, like, you know, maybe like $5-$10 of geopolitical premium in that barrel, that could clear up. Because I do think eventually Iran is pretty rational actor, and they don't want war with the U.S. They need to react, but they'll be very deliberate in their reaction. It's just my guess, but I could see it. But my point is, I could see, you know, you remove that geopolitical premium, I could see oil come down, and then after that, I think we fall onto the more kind of structural underpinning of what I think is going to be a super cycle for commodity, but not a demand driven super cycle, more of a supply driven super cycle, in the sense that we haven't invested a lot in the sector and exploration for many years because of ESG, because of the push to go into renewable, and we still have fairly strong demand. We have OPEC that's a lot more aggressive than we thought it would be, and then U.S. shale production. It took a lot of it in 2023, but, you know, there's probably a limit as to how much we can produce. So long term, I remain somewhat bullish, but I think, you know, that late last spike to like above 90 on Brent, you know, will probably get corrected in the coming weeks.
Mm. Let's talk about the other political threat out there, and that is the election here in the U.S. We already just established that the only bipartisan agreement is to spend. I mean, there's no sign of fiscal discipline or constraint, especially leading into election. But you said that time's running out for the Fed to get real on inflation, and you're worried about the outcome of the election sparking even more inflation. Walk us through that. What does that mean?
Let's stick with, you know, the two most probable outcomes, which is, you know, either Biden gets reelected or Trump. I mean, if Biden gets reelected, basically it's more of the same. We just saw, I think it was like a week ago, student loan debt relief, right? I mean,
yeah.
So
it's in the headlines today. Yeah, another $7 billion.
Yeah, here you go. You know, like more. I mean, it's very hard to imagine, Damascus conversion of the people who've been spending like drunken sailors are likely to keep spending like drunken sailors. So I think we can lay that to rest. And then the other one, which I think is the more likely, is a Trump victory. And then, like, talk about inflation shock here. I mean, Trump has many, you know, changed his views many times on many topics. But one area two areas that I think he's really kind of part of core Trumpism is, one is protectionism. I mean, if you look at videos of him from the early 80s, he was already talking about like the Japanese stealing our job. And then, so I think truly, truly he believes, that the trade deficit is something that needs to be cut, that, you know, so he, that part I think is going to be really, like, maybe transactional in his approach. He may pick on certain countries to save some others, but overall, he threatened a 60% tariff on Chinese export and 10% across the board. Can you imagine that? I mean, the shock, like if we do see that, I mean, it's going to be huge. And then the second part that, you know, Trump is, you know, I think consistent about is, you know, he's a New York real estate guy. Like, he's made money with leverage. I mean, he's a debt guy. He wants low rates, more debt, and juice it up. A Trump election victory would be extremely bullish for inflation. And when we saw that trade in 2016, right? I mean, on that night when he got elected, you saw the break even just completely go through the roof, long-term rates go through the roof, cyclicals rally. And then you had the question. So let's say that the Fed hasn't cut by then, which I hope they don't, because that would be a mistake. Then we would have to talk about hikes. I mean, because you'd get a legitimate inflationary shock from the election. So, you know, instead of talking about cuts, you'd have to talk about rate hikes.
And even if he wants lower rates, even if he fires Powell and gets someone in there who's like, sure, I'll cut rate, it doesn't mean the bond market rates will go lower. If we are looking at that,
you see your term premium. Yeah, you see your, you know, bond market vigilantes, term premium goes up. Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, one strategy I highlighted in that investing for a recession-free future is being long break-evens. And that's something that, you know, we've advised our institutional clients to do with CPA swaps, kind of purest way to do that, where, you know, you pay a fixed rate and you receive the inflation in return. Now, that's not very practical for a retail investors, but you can replicate that with very popular ETFs. One is, you know, you go short TLT, the long-term treasury, and then you go long and inflation-protected fund, TIP, invest in TIPS, and the resulting position is synthetic position that's long break evens, and I think that's the trade either way, because yes, it could be that maybe we go full Arthur Burns, right? Maybe Trump bullies Powell and Powell caves, or you know, Trump nominates or
more likely replaces him.
Yeah, I think it's 2026. I think is when his mandate is up.
I mean, he could, you know,
right. So
this is.
Yeah, if that's the case, yeah. your long rate, you know, your short long term bonds not going to work, right? Or if you have like straight up financial repression, I would not pass it beyond. I mean, we had it in the 50s, for example. So being short rates, short long term yields will not work, but being long tips, long break evens is what's going to make you money. So,
do you think this scenario is priced in at all?
No. No, I mean, barely starting. I mean, you look at break evens. I mean, the one that really popped up, much to my pleasure, were the short ones, like 2-year break even. I think it's about 3% right now. I think at this point, just acknowledging reality, right? I mean, yeah, we have, you know, like inflation is at, you know, 3.5%. So yeah, it's not coming down. So it's just basically accepting what is. But the long term break even is probably 10-year. You're looking at 2.5%. Which, you know, if I'm right about inflation, I think that the better number is probably around 3.5.
And just going straight tips isn't enough. You would, or if you want to really get.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with being, you know, long tip is, you know, you have two components to your tip return, right? You have a real rate, and then you have the inflation adjustment. So in my scenario, I think eventually the real rates would come out as well. Like this is what we saw in 2022. I mean, you should think, oh, inflation went to 9%. Tip should have been great. No, you got destroyed with tip because real rates went up at the same time. Mm-hmm. So you hedge that real rate component by being short. In the case, I took TLT, but I mean, if I wanted to do it perfectly, I would match a duration. So TLT is long duration, tip is shorter, but whatever, but you go short kind of regular government notes and bonds to hedge that the risk that real rates are going to go up.
This is such an important conversation because the minute you veer into talking about the election, it seems partisan. This is not partisan. This is just gaming out what is likely based on, you know, the outcomes. And I think it's really important for people at least to be able to divide their head about what they might want politically and then what might happen to their portfolio. You don't like some other inflation hedges that are very popular right now, including gold and Bitcoin, even oil. You don't think any of those would work in this situation? Why?
Yeah. I mean,
or just they don't work.
What I want to say, it's important that you say the full time, I don't like these assets as inflation hedges, not right. On their own merit. I mean, I think there's certainly a very good case for owning gold. And then, you know, obviously Bitcoin has performed very well. Oil, I think, has a place in portfolio, maybe more in the end. I'd probably prefer the energy companies than the commodity itself. But the point I was making was that if you just look at what worked during periods of inflation surprise, so I use the City Inflation Surprise Index, as my referee, and whenever you had inflation surprise on the upside, actually gold Even Bitcoin, Bitcoin was just, I mean, Bitcoin generally is all over the map, right? So it's kind of hard to find a gold to some extent too with less volatility. And, but even oil really didn't work all that well. And part of the reason is because these assets have a built-in sensitivity to interest rates. And typically when you have a higher than expected inflation, rates go up. So, you know, your kind of inflation hedge wants to move higher, but then your rate sensitive asset wants to go lower. So you don't get that pure bet on inflation, which is why I like the cleanest way is this CPI swap, right? That's just the cleanest way, but you can't do that as a rate investor. So you replicate that with this synthetic long tip, short TLT position. And that has the expected relation, consistently positive relation with inflation surprises.
Amazing stuff. Vincent, I love when you come on. You're always thought provoking. Your research is super original and really sort of forward looking. So we just always appreciate when you come on and share. It's just great stuff.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
A lot to think about over the weekend. That's for sure. So thank you for that. Just a programming note for everyone. I know we just on the heels of that, Vincent just, you know, talking about, does Bitcoin really work as a hedge? There's a lot of opinions about Bitcoin, where it's going as an investment or a hedge. And it gets even more heated when you start to go out into the altcoin, NFT, token universe. There's a lot going on. So what do you need to know? How does it fit in for you? Should it be something you're considering? How do you navigate it all? We're going to help you make sense of it. We fired up another festival of learning because of everything that's going on. So join us 18th and 19th of April for a free online festival. It's free, but you do have to register. So go to realvision.com/FOL to register. Brian will drop it in all the chats. It's going to be a great one. Vincent, thank you so much. Have a wonderful weekend. And thanks to all of you for the great questions and for turning up as usual. Have a great one. We'll see you next week.
It's crypto summer, which means it's festival season. At Real Vision, we're getting ready for the next Festival of Learning in partnership with Kraken. It's taking place April 18 and 19, and the theme is Don't F Up Alts, Memes, and NFTs. Yep, there's a big world of digital assets beyond Bitcoin and ETH with lots of opportunity and lots of risk. We'll be bringing a ton of timely and actionable knowledge from speakers including Raoul Powell, Sergio Silva, Kevin Kelly, OSF, and more. It's completely free to attend. Just go to realvision.com/festivalofLearning to get the details and save your seat. We'll see you there.